to walk all the way around.
I know that before.
You ready? Are we ready?
Oh, yeah. It's good. You're on.
Okay, I'm on page 3B1, page Gimel Amud Bet in the Gemara and Megillah. So if you're with me, you're on 3B1 in the Art Scroll. And I'm also on Rava Said in the text. So Amar Rava. It is in the continuation, in the narrow lines about, I don't know, 10, 12 lines down. On Gimel Bet. Okay. So we'll launch right in tonight because, as I explained in Megillah, the reason why you have a lot of returning back to the same subject matter is not necessarily because of the subject matter of either reading the Megillah or the walled cities per se. You're working out some very foundational, philosophical, rabbinic principles. And this is among Talmud passages, potentially some of the places where you get some of the deepest philosophical stances of the rabbis. This is rabbi's philosophy, rabbi's machshava, the thought process of the rabbis. And one of the areas that we're about to launch into in the Gemara, from where Rava speaks, is about the issue of prioritization in law. That the rhetoric of the rabbis here, not in a legal, codific kind of way, the rhetoric will promote the question in worshipers, in Jews, what do I do in a situation of the good and the good? Very unique to legal texts. That's not part of great Western law codes. In other words, when some opportunity to be a good citizen stands in front of me, and I know it's two major categories of mitzvah, because I'm talking about being a citizen of Am Yisrael, what happens when I'm faced with this opportunity and that opportunity, which takes precedence? That's why this part of the Gemara is going to introduce certain mitzvot that are associated with Purim. We're in Masechet Megillah. That makes sense. And we're also going to talk about mitzvot that are not necessarily connected to Purim, per se. Amar Rava. Rava says, Pshita li avoda mikra Megillah. It's obvious to me that when the conflict arises between the mitzvot of the sacrificial service and the Megillah reading, Mikra Megillah Adif, Midah Rav Yossi Bar Chanina, because the Megillah reading takes precedence, as we already heard in the statement of Rav Yossi Bar Chanina. What did Rav Yossi Bar Chanina say? He learned that when it came to include the Kohen and Levite families, the Mishpacha Mishpacha, the part of the verse that was about families, that they, if they were going to be in the middle of their temple service, could abandon it and go hear the reading of the Megillah. What's so progressive, what's so radical about the notion that the Mikra Megillah is a rabbinic mitzvah? The Avoda, of course, is a Torahic mitzvah. And the rabbinic mitzvah takes precedence. Rava recites another undisputed ruling. Talmud Torah u'Mikra Megillah. In a conflict between the study of Torah and Mikra Megillah, the reading of the Megillah, Mikra Megillah Adiv, Megillah reading takes precedence. Midisamchu shel Beit Rabbi. Since the rabbis of the school of Rabbi relied on that Kal v'Chomer, which we ultimately went through last time. Talmud Torah u'Mitzvah. But let's talk about the situation of where you have Talmud study and obligation to bury an unattended corpse. Now,
you mean at the same time?
Yeah.
So what you do is you have a certain amount of time
Let's say you're running to go to a major, major lecture from a rabbi who traveled all the way from Eretz Yisrael. Remember, because Talmud Torah in this case is not just like you walk out of your apartment on 3rd Avenue and you step around the corner to the shul you're a part of. You're on your way to hear one of the premier minds of the generation in a world of no popularity contests and People magazine. You're going to hear the top darshan. Because through the grapevine, this is what people were so excited about. All word of mouth. No billboards. You're on your way, and all of a sudden, you see that there is an unattended corpse. Mind you, remember, they have to carry the corpse out of the house. It's a possibility. Or someone was sleeping on the side of the road. It's a possibility. Now, met mitzvah adif, the mitzvah of an unattended corpse takes precedence. We feel this in our own way around the shul. We feel this in our own way about that. But the rabbis are going to explicate it to the point where if some felt that they were not necessarily obligated to take care of the issue, to take care of the corpse, not even a matter to be debated. Many issues can be debated. Even the deepest questions of life and death can be debated. But let's set up a sicha, let's set up a Talmudic discussion here about what's most essential. How could it be a question? Let's talk about how it could be a question before we read the end of the conversation. Why do you think, and this I'm asking you directly, why do you think that the conversation, that the Gemara's potential Hava Amina could be whether or not Talmud Torah is more important than really caring for an unattended corpse? Talk about new subject matter.
Which thing is more important, or whether it's incumbent upon you to participate?
Okay, so A, it could be really sensitively dealing with the U factor. But I'm going to press it, though, even with the U factor. What's the underlying notion of the question about an individual regarding walking by an unattended corpse versus going to study? Because whomever it is, don't you think that as a matter of life and death, like, can you imagine someone walking by a dead body in New York City and not stopping?
Absolutely.
So since you can imagine it, what is the underlying nature of the question? What philosophically, what is at the heart of the matter? The dignity of human life? And how about for the passerby?
It's the protection for yourself, which is also a consideration. You don't know how that person died. In our contemporary society, that's why people claim they don't get involved. But at least they should call the police.
Okay. So we should say that at least you could call the police.
Well, in our society, we don't bother to clarify somebody's sick. We assume the person is drunk or asleep.
Right.
We don't care.
That's true.
Sometimes that happens. So what is that saying about our humanity?
We're protecting ourselves.
That people will protect themselves. That people will ignore the conversation about death, let alone actually deal with the death of another human being whom they have no shaykhut. They have no connection. The Gemara, I believe, realizes it. The rabbis want to present to us in the context of all of the questions of the celebrations and the death of many militaristically, the kind of overarching theme of death that comes, I think this is what's happening, out of the Megillah, whether you've taken death into your own hands or you don't, if you're fighting for a civil society, and that's why you're fighting, coming out of the Megillah reality, because all these verses are about that celebration, now, what are you really fighting for? Where does it put the individual in regards to death itself, dead bodies, the pillars of what we understand are the mode of how to live, what we see as important, and whether or not we are willing to get involved, in addition to being permitted to be involved, when it comes to finding a corpse and having what's called the Met Mitzvah, very specific case where you have a corpse that needs care. Now, in the example of at least call the police in today's world, you could say that maybe at that time already there were groups of people like the Chevra Kedisha that we know about that dealt with this. But it's not going to suggest that you put the call out to the people in the town who deal with that body.
But isn't the text that specific? I mean, I stopped to pay attention because we have a class. Are you posing one possibility of what's being discussed? There is the question about people in a Beit Midrash, if they know there is proof that he's intended to, do you interrupt study and leave? Because in a case like that, there can be an assumption, as you said, that there are other people who are dealing with it. Maybe the question is, do you not make that assumption? Do you get involved because of the need to participate? But is the example you've spoken of what's literally being mentioned, or is that one possibility?
Let's say that's definitely the possibility that I read in, based on what we're going to read down the line with which situations are being dealt with among the order of preferences by way of mitzvot that are discussed. However, you're doing oftentimes, right, Rishonim will do exactly that move, that word that you're purporting as a possibility right now, and that we can see that in this case, it might not be so much about the example exactly the way I described it. How about this, right? And that suggestion of how about I'm sitting in the Beit Midrash and somebody says there's a mate outside, we have to go deal with this, you could be asking the question, shall I get up? Am I permitted to? Is it incumbent upon me or not? So, fully with you, and that's why reading the text actually to a certain point is always good. Because absolutely the possibilities are somewhat, you know, within bounds, different from the situation that I'm purporting. Okay, so Talmud Torah Met Mitzvah. Torah study or the obligation to bury an unattended corpse. That obligation is incumbent upon everyone, and anyone who encounters it has the chiyuv to do the mitzvah, is generally the way it's understood. Again, making it a little bit more like a situation that I'm describing with encountering the corpse.
Where does it say that?
It says that in a Braita, here. It says that in the following, it's taught in the Braita. Ready? Mevatlin Talmud Torah lehotzat meit or lehachnasat kala. We have a tradition from the Mishnaic age that says Torah study is suspended to take out the dead, meaning that you have to attend to the corpse's need if you encounter it, and to accompany a bride from her father's place to the wedding hall. Meaning what? Somehow there's a procession of that kala that all of a sudden you walk out, you know, you kind of see these movies where someone's coming out of their business deal and they've got the briefcase and they walk into the street and all of a sudden, you know, they're in the parade. You could describe for yourself such a thing going on in the Jewish community. Other possibility is that someone's made the announcement, hey, you're sitting in the Beit Midrash, do you know that there's a wedding going on? Towns in which such events happen to this day, create a certain kind of swarming in on the celebration hall. You know, you don't wait for a formal invitation for some of these things in certain communities.
Well, isn't the first instance here what we saw during the war, when strangers would go to the soldiers' funeral? I mean, is this really, and here we see, it's about human dignity in both cases, for there to be a crowd around, because what's more opposite than the bride and the corpse? But I mean, that's why I'm just saying, is this Literally, obviously, one maybe should have walked past a corpse, but is this talking about it being incumbent upon people to attend a funeral generally? Or is that not at all what's being?
We're talking about a mate who needs real care. And it could be expanded. Again, could be expanded, but to read it with the notion of the mitzvah involved, you have a corpse that needs attending.
So does this refer to any kala, or a kala who perhaps people need to chip in to make the Bagan event a festivity?
It's a nice question, the same way that the Rishonim often will splice it and say, is it any kala? That's definitely one possibility that you'll see in Middle Ages texts. You know, are we talking about any kala? Are we talking about just some kala? Are we talking about those who need the attention? Mind you, the notion that Rabbi Elijah Shochet talks about,
it would be analogous.
Right, in a certain way. But Rabbi Elijah Shochet, who's a teacher of codes and an expert in codific literature from throughout the Middle Ages, really claims, and did so in California in a series of lectures, that it's really not about only the poor situation. And he specifically addressed that issue. Why? Because we might think in our privileged kind of realities that you only go to someone who you don't know if you're really helping. He called it the help factor. And the halacha wants you to be so involved in community that when you hear the bris is at 9 a.m. on Thursday, you're there. Right? There's no invitations traditionally to a bris, so we're not talking about a bris. But even with the wedding, interestingly, the Ateres Charna, I think I've mentioned it to you before, it's the wedding hall in New Square. So when Square Chassidim or other people get married at Ateres Charna, there are two doors, the women's side and the men's side. There are internal doors. These you know are the men's and these you know are the women's. There's a huge front hall, and to add to the celebration, you have two kinds of people that come wandering in who weren't particularly the ones invited, who were sitting at the tables. It's totally Jewish wedding crashers, and there are some poor, and when you go to a wedding in that community, you bring dollar bills, and you should bring at least 18, you know, so that you hand out dollar bills to those poor who attend the wedding. There's enough food so that you have some tables outside, because they always put those tables in, as the tradition goes. And there are people who come with learning and Talmud Torah to support the notion of the celebration through their Talmud. So you'll have people come to a wedding with a Gemara in their hand, and they'll find a Ruta who's ready to learn with them, and they'll do it in the front hallway, and they'll sit inside and do it inside. It's a cultural phenomenon that I've experienced several times. I've been invited when I lived there.
We've been to a number of the Brooklyn of these weddings, and there are the selected ones who are allowed to go collect money from...
Not on the women's side.
Yeah, on the men's side. And it's all very routinized and sanctioned. And there is this sense of a crowd. And the chuppah, they always say the chuppah is whatever time, it's actually several hours later, before they really get to it.
True.
It's this amazing thing, because the men and the women are separated, and they come to, the only time they come to a point is actually the bride and the groom.
Right.
So all of the others back up behind them, separated, but it's only the bride, the groom, and their parents that are actually seeing each other sort of face to face. It's the orchestration is quite remarkable.
And they know how to do it each time. It's like clockwork.
On another note, I think after what you're saying, I was in Istanbul this summer with the family, and when they do the call to prayer, the imam, several times a day, at one of the calls, they will announce the people from that neighborhood who died, with the expectation that apparently that people will then come to the funeral.
Wow.
That's the job of the imam. It's not only that. He calls for work. In Arab villages, they call for many others, fire.
But
that's the job of the imam. It's not just religious. It's right, the loudspeaker.
Yeah. No, but it is. But what, I think what's,
they take the opportunity.
You know, I think in this particular neighborhood, that's not everywhere. Very interesting. So, you know, that is like the public notion. And the public notion that Rabbi Shelfer would talk about, when something good was happening in the community, you really did have a little bit more of that procession. People would obviously process to the funeral, to the burial site. They would process to the chuppah. And when you go to these, and you talk about that convergence, that is a very long walk in certain communities where they all know exactly how to do that and to maintain their separation. And that long walk allows others to join in and be part of it even when it's not exactly that they were connected at first. And if you get caught up in the midst of that, Rabbi Shlomo once told us that he was caught up in the midst of a march down the street in Jerusalem for a wedding. So he spent the day
at the wedding.
At the wedding, missed his class. Students, you know, ultimately learned a little something and it went on. And it's you know, it's very concrete, and there are questions to ask. You know, to whom does this apply today? How could we still live it in a modern context? I think those are wonderful questions. Rava continues. Avoda umeid mitzvah. Now let's go through another kind of balancing act here. Which is more important? How do we prioritize? Now, we got a couple lawyers in here. I just made the claim before, and I want to ask you. Is it true or not true, as I claim, that the good and the good, right? The temple service and taking care of the corpse, two very, very essential mitzvot, two very, very essential mitzvot from the Torah, that it plays out in legal terms and rhetorical terms, at least, the kind of prioritization I have to make between two goods, right? That's a feature, potentially a feature of a legal system and a legal corpus of discussions that I don't know is really part of the American system, the British system, or any other system for that matter, right? We don't see it in Roman law.
Not sure I understand
you. In other words, if I have a legal discussion going on in the Gemara that says, shall I do Talmud Torah? Should I do Torah study? Or should I do the sacrificial service of the temple? Right? Two good things, two positive things. No code that says, thou shalt not. We have positive mitzvot here. And then there's a legal discussion about which is adif. We have a systematic approach here to kind of ranking in priority order what a person should do given the reality that squarely faces you. Right? That's an interesting kind of lesson to take from Talmudic literature. That I have to go through a little bit of a question in my mind as to which, now, triage can make a different argument. Like, triage in and of itself can be compared to such a systemic look at how I make decisions about which mitzvot I'm going to engage in. And that comparison, I think, would be really interesting in and of itself. What I'm asking is, in our legal system, is there ever a place where, you know, there's a way to fulfill one good in terms of civil society versus another, and legal advice, not from your lawyer, but, you know, kind of in the codes, this one is really preferable over that one?
I think of the law itself when you transgress. I think of the law is when you transgress, but I think that choosing between goods is a sense of values that are not so much legal, because they don't have an enforcement by law, at least in our society. When you're choosing between goods, they may have had the force of law in that society, or the force of custom and communal expectation, but not the force of law, which I think is deserved for when you actually go on the flip side of doing something that isn't good.
I can't honestly think of an example of two goods and the requirement to choose between them. I'm not sure. I just can't think.
Mm-hmm.
But I might have missed this, but it seems to me there's an assumption in this discussion Torah study takes precedence over everything. And now we have to find other exceptions to that rule.
Maybe that's the premise. Of course, they're marketing Talmud Torah as being essential to the whole project, which we did say last week. And Talmud Torah was discussed by way of, is it of the general public, or is it by the Yachid, by the individual person? And does Mikra Megillah actually take precedence over it? Right? Coming to do this Derabbanan mitzvah of reading the Megillah, maybe because it was time-bound to a certain day, that's the exception, right? Mm-hmm. It's true. We're relating it to very central principles.
So there's an assumption that if you have choices to make,
good deeds versus Talmud Torah. That Talmud Torah is equal to them all, because it leads to them all, even in some of the more free translations. That comes from the Gemara itself, but the problem is that that idea of Talmud Torah keneged kulam, Talmud Torah is equal and equivalent to them all, maybe like as in some of the modern translations, because it leads to them all. By the way, there are several mitzvot that are discussed that are like that, like tzedakah.
Well, the two
here speak about keneged means.
Right, and connected has a valence, has a somewhat of a negative valence if you want to push it that way. Not everybody looks at it that way.
Well, I realize that, in effect, that you're putting that against the others, so sometimes the choice does need to be made.
Well, but these two examples both have an immediacy to them, too. You've got to do it right then with the corpse and with the bride.
Right.
You can't put that off and...
If it is that you're joining into the procession of the bride versus planning a wedding and making sure funds of it, immediacy, and on the immediacy level, this is one of the things that I think is inherent in the Gemara and why it's philosophical and machshevet chazal and Jewish thought and not necessarily about, you know, is it Purim day and this happens to me? Because the rabbis are saying that your life must be lived reflectively, and when it comes to immediate kind of responses, that there are some prioritization systems that can be at work, and I know with these specific things that I can prioritize, and then I also know that I kind of have to use that notion of prioritizing between the good and the good. And that's a real achievement if we can prioritize between the good and the good. That's Jewish values at work. That's the ethical kind of life we want to live.
So what happens if there is a dead and a bride, a wedding at the same time, or two dead at the same time?
Yeah, you know what? So nobody asks those questions on the page. They needed you to actually ask those questions. Nobody asked those questions.
No, because if that's you prioritize the immediacy and it's two different places, or the same place going two different directions.
You know what my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Cohen would say? He would say, write down those questions, and after we read this passage, you'll have enough textual reality to start an answer, and then look for a couple weddings, look for a couple of courses to attend to, and then tell me what you think after you do it. In other words, but he was really serious.
Nowadays, in Jerusalem, you have, in the same place, the wedding and murder at the same time.
Right.
So it's not far-fetched, no, what I'm telling you.
And what I'm not saying it is. I'm giving you an honest Beit Midrash answer. We are prioritizing. We're doing the mitzvah of Talmud Torah in order to get to... study this halacha, and they go to collect the, God forbid, you know, body parts with great holiness, and they know the law, and they want to apply it, and they want to do what's adif. They want to do what's preferable before they do what's not. That's why this is at the core also of a rabbinic life, of a rabbinic system life, of a Jewish life, that you have to see this as the spurring on to really think through those things. You can't stop you. You know, some people would say, oh my goodness, that's, you know, it's almost like a OCD in a certain way, obsessive compulsive to be thinking, what's the priority here? Like, which mitzvah am I supposed to be doing, and how am I supposed to be doing this? And that's the quality in living a totally, you know, legalistic halachic life that can sometimes be very off-putting to those who think that To be too punctilious is absolutely putting down the humanity and my ability to respond in the moment. Whereas this is saying no enough in the moment to actually respond, and may it be between the good and the good.
I believe there's a classic example that's a little bit variation of that. What happens if the bride is at the wedding, bridegroom at a wedding, and the father of one of them dies at the wedding? Do you stop the wedding and take care of it? Or what do you do when you have the death and you go into mourning and everything? And I believe the answer is that you go on with the wedding. It's kind of interesting because here you have a death and a wedding, and you put together in an example, and that's the importance of staying with the bride, and you continue with the happy thing, even though the parent has died. I forget whether they say it's the father of the bride or the father of the groom, but some of them. So that is similar to what you're
correct,
saying.
But that's when the wedding is already in process.
Well, no, I think you're not. My understanding is if the father of the bride died a week before, you would go on with the wedding, but not with the celebration. Right, so again, you wouldn't interrupt. But
you've got a corpse right over here also, right. And you have the bride, and you continue with the wedding, so it's kind of interesting that they've got these two.
It's almost like a feeling in a movie.
No, I'm sorry. So I'm saying that the immediacy is certainly sounds like this is immediate, but the other way to slice it is communal activity, Jewish communal activity. Because, in both cases, you're engaged in something that, and even hearing the Megillah. So those are communal events, not individual events, whereas reading Talmud Torah is, maybe with a small group or whatever, but it's not this larger communal relationship. And so I wonder if the sense of community isn't so important that's coming into play in creating a hierarchy.
Right, so all these are the kind of questions that arise from these pages, and we could take specific instances, and we could put it communal or individual. The rabbis definitely are interested in individual responses, but I don't doubt that you could put this in the greater context of community.
Didn't we study just a year or two ago in here when the doctor has to choose between saving the life of the mother and saving the life of the child?
Right, we're talking about Sanhedrin as well, and there is a Seder Adifud, there's a right. An order of preference
that's
over one
the best life that you have a death tells
you. Yeah, well, and then you've got talking about the goods, you've got the choice of who you save.
Right.
If someone's drowning, a couple of people drowning.
Right. Or yourself, if you only have the water, in the classic
right.
example.
Yeah.
So we know that this is all over the route. Now you guys are bringing from experience all the different pieces that you've heard in the rabbinic parlance to say that this is an essential piece of machshevet chazal, of rabbinic thought, is indeed true. And sometimes it's exactly like it. Sometimes it's a little bit different based on the notion of what are we really trying to protect? What's the greatest value at bay here? The life of the mother, in that case. So we are definitely saying that Talmud Torah, at this point, can be released from it, and you should not necessarily be wrapped up in the limud, in the learning, and in that maybe, you want to bring it to fast forward, into the thinking what I should do here, when you need to do something that affirms the dignity of life. That's how general we can take it. So let's keep reading now, and we'll try to sail through some of the material about it. Avodah met mitzvah. So in a conflict between the sacrificial service and the mitzvah of the unattended corpse, adiv, met mitzvah adiv, milachoto. How do I learn that actually doing the mitzvah of burying the unattended corpse, because I need a derivation, I need to learn it from somewhere, so I learn it from laachoto. That is a quote from the verse that deals with a Nazir, the Nazirite who takes an oath. The Nazirite takes an oath who's prohibited from coming into contact with a human corpse, and from cutting his hair, and from drinking wine, or partaking of any grape product. Look at Nazir 6.5. I gave you chapter 6. Go to Mishnah 5. It's on 79. Three things are forbidden to a Nazir. Shlosha mini nasurim the Nazir. Hatuma vaha vahat tiglachat vayotzei min hagefen. Three things are forbidden to a Nazir. Uncleanness, in other words, actually attending to a dead body, shaving, and that which comes from the grapevine, in other words, wine. So that is what we know from a Nazir, except we just said met mitzvah is possible. Why? Well, it's ultimately going to get to the point where it says, and if he doesn't become Tameh, if he doesn't have Tumah, if he doesn't deal with the dead body of his sister, that's extraneous information, though, and if it's making such a definitive distinction, or it's teaching something so specific in terms of his Nazirite vows, then obviously it's only specific to his sister, and not so specific as to a met mitzvah, as to dealing with a corpse who needs attention. Right? The assumption is that his family will take care of it, or others will take care of the relatives who have died. Don't be worried that we're just leaving them, and he has no one to attend to the deaths in the family. So, in other words, the Braita is now going to teach. I have this word, this verse that says he shouldn't become impure about his mother, his father, his brother, and his sister. I'm back in the Gemara now, page 3b2, on the left-hand side. Zitanya lachoto, ma talmud lomar. What do I learn from the fact that it says, or for his sister? I mean, there's an extra word there. Ha rei shehaya alech lishchodet pischo v'lamul et b'no. If one was going to slaughter his Pesach sacrifice or to circumcise his son, we take a little bit of a digression, and we actually see that we're talking about some other mitzvahs here too, things that are obligations by the Torah. V'shama shemet lo meid, and he heard that one of his relatives had died, yachol yitameh. We might say that the verse with all of the distinctions, with all the words themselves about his family members, would say he could become tameh, even though he's taken a vow not to become impure from the one who dies. Well, Amrat lo yitame. You therefore say, do not become tame. No, sorry. Yachol k'shem she'eno mitame la'achoto. It could be that just as he does not become tame for his sister, and he lets others deal with the needs of the death, kach eino mitame la'meid mitzvah. We might say that also, of course, he doesn't deal with the corpse that's unattended in terms of needing it. Well, what we do say is Talmud lomar la'achoto. Talmud, the Torah came and taught specifically the notion of he doesn't get made impure for dealing with his sister, ulachoto, who the eino mitame aval mitame lemid mitzvah. And we say that it specifically specified this for the fact that he could indeed deal with the met mitzvah, even though he can't become tame, he can't become impure, because the Torah says, not for his sister. In other words, the specification of those for which he cannot is limited vis-a-vis the met mitzvah for whom he can become tameh. So the specific words led us to that conclusion. Having stated all the obvious rulings, Rava now inquires about a doubtful case, because that one was clear as daylight. Vai Rava. Rava says the following. He asks, Mikra Megillah met mitzvah. Hey, minayu adif. Let's put two different ones, zeh against zeh, right? As you had formulated your questions, there's a certain number they'll ask you, or there's a certain amount they won't. Rava says, if the mitzvahs of Megillah reading and burying an unattended corpse conflict, which one takes precedence? Now, what's the underlying piece here that we have to remember? Mikra Megillah is the Rabbanon or Deraita? The Rabbanon. It's a rabbinic legislation. The other, Deraita. Mikra Megillah Adif, Mishum Pirsum Anisa. It says the actual reading of the Megillah is the one that takes precedence, because it publicizes the miracle that God performed for us on Purim. Remember that the force of this could be read in either two ways. Generally, it's read like a question. Mikra Megillah Adif, Mishum Pirsum Anisa. Might we suggest that the Mikra of the Megillah the reading of the Megillah is preferable here, is the one that has to be done first, because it's actually talking about great miracles that God performed, and it has to be done, what, according to a certain time frame? Shall we say that? Oh, Dilma, and the reason why we read it as a question is because of the technical term of oh, Dilma. Or perhaps, do we admit mitzvah adif mishum kavod abriot? Or perhaps we say that the mitzvah of attending the corpse on the side, or the corpse that needs attending, is the precedental mitzvah because human dignity is at stake. Batar devaya hadar peshata. Beautiful, technical, not found so often, wonderful moment of personal reflection and insight, as opposed to being challenged by any other rav, as opposed to being, you know, kind of challenged by another brisa thrown by the editor of the Gemara. What does he do? Rava goes and thinks to himself and says the following.
Have we seen that before?
Not with me. It's not found that often in Gemara. Right. So it's this rare moment of deep personal reflection, as with the rhetoric and the rhetorical question that's being asked in the Gemara. He goes and he thinks to himself. And he says, Met mitzvah atif. Dealing with this unattended corpse takes precedence. The Amar Mar Gadol Kavod Abriyot Shidoche et Lo Ta'aseh Shebet Torah. For the Master said, human dignity is so great that it even suspends the prohibition of the Torah. Period. And that's the end. Well, you know, we don't have a name here.
And it wasn't assumed that if you say the name,
if it's self-referential, then that's one possibility. If it's my teacher, if it's God, if it's the whole project.
Well, if God said it, it would be in the
Torah. What was not said specifically in that certain way? They learned out the mitzvah, but...
He said that a wise man once
I think it's in a certain way not arrogant. I don't think. I think what he's saying is that I must say that my question is not even a question. And you know, there's certain times the rabbis will say that. You know, in the few times that it's there. Bottom line, kavod abriot.
This is defining the value system.
This is the refinement and the defining of the value system.
Why do they call it kavod abriot and not kavod amet?
Yafe. Question is a good question on the Gemara's choice of language and Rava's choice of language. Briot means the creations of God. Why wouldn't it just say may? Because A, you could answer the question within internal language, that we brought up the issue of the Kala, we brought up the issue of the bride, and now I'm including everybody in God's creations. Two, they're teaching the larger value of Kavod Abriot. And for sure they're attaching themselves to other places where Kavod Abriot is used. What do you think about those who have some rabbinic textual parlance? Could remember, maybe I'll draw it out if you don't remember exactly, Pirkei Avot uses Kavod Abriot. Pirkei Avot teaches that you have to be Rodef Shalom. You have to pursue peace. Using that Rodef word that you brought up before from Sanhedrin, we pursue life in all matters and Shalom. And Kavod Abriot is attributed to some of the greatness of Aaron, the high priest, even with all his human reality and struggle. But this is the definition, this is really the defining moment of deep rabbinic values. I love the Batar Devaya Hadar Peshata. He went back on himself, he thought to himself, and he answered his own question. That's the sense, I think, not of arrogance, of real rabbinic humility, and ultimately defining Arkei Yahadut, Jewish values. Okay.
I think it's great, actually. I mean, I think that the concept of human dignity is, and the universality of it, is an extraordinary statement of ethical principles. Of course, from the standpoint of people who pass words, of course, then you get a definition. And what constitutes one commitment to human dignity versus another, and there obviously there'll always be different perspectives. But I think it's a defining feature that is linearly transmitted in Jewish thought to the present day. Obviously, not everybody buying in necessarily, but I think it remains the central tenet of Western civilization in terms of the starting from the creation of humans in God's image.
Can I just ask, Bill? The definition of that is not only human, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, you could be very expensive.
Yeah, I mean, this is living, this is life. So
you could be very expensive. The way that it's taught to very young children is to be inclusive of all things, especially animals. Of course, it gets to the pinnacle because even if we are somewhat biocentric and not only humanocentric, but it does get to the pinnacle of trying to teach this value that we are created in Tzelem Elohim, exactly like you're saying, in the image of God, or forget even the image of God, that you just have to have Kavod Abriot. You've got to have this. You've got to do everything you can to help dignify God's creation. It's very difficult, I think, when we see sometimes the very nature of humanity, the ability to be a perpetrator. And this is what stands over and against any of the kind of consistent work towards human dignity that
got to pick up this morning's
exactly, but one act at a time responds to that call, right? And I think the rabbis are really calling us out individually and saying respond to that. And this moment of self-reflection by the one Rav who's asking the question, then who gets to this answer, is there for them reflective of it. Now, he's doing something more. Here's the next level of reading this by way of the Jewish thought and rabbinic thought. He's saying, and you know what? My own legislation, my own rabbinic legislation that I thought was so important that could doche et avodah, that could push off the temple service, shedoche et Talmud Torah, that stops learning Torah, which is a mitzvah right from the Torah, that ultimately the mitzvah of following the rabbi's words as a mitzvah qua following the rabbi's words, lo tasur, don't disregard them. He's taking that upon himself to say, sometimes, yeah, you got to veer right for kavod abriyot. And that's the piece about the Rabbanan and Daraita that's being played out by his last answer as well.
Is this term Kvod Abriyot always translated as human dignity? It's not a literal translation.
Right, it generally is, and it's respect for God's creations is how it's translated as well.
Zechel Maser Bresh, you would say. So it's not so much your own individual view of yourself in your place in society. It's a view of society superseding, we talked about it, not so much communal, it's showing respect for God's work.
Right. Right. It is. And you could put it at that level and not be so philosophically inclined to say, how does being created in God's image and being, you know, each person looking at one another...
Well, you could fill in the blank.
It truly is saying that there are ways that we define how to be respectful of God's creation. Okay. Now let's get back quickly, and then we'll kind of get out of, you know, the Gemara going back. Does one of these gufas. You've had gufa before. Okay. We're going to go to walled cities. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, Krach v'chol hasamuchlo. A walled city as well as everything that's near it. Now let's get out of this conversation about people individually and go back to conversation about walled cities. What's at stake in this conversation? Maybe who listens, what day they read it on, for sure, right? Because the Mishnah was trying to find out. But moreover, again, here's the piece that I drew out of this today, and that you can think about as I move into the text. What in your mind, in your personal definition, what, quote-unquote, makes a place a city? Okay? What makes a place a city?
Split jobs and trading.
Okay.
Where you split jobs and you trade with one another. That's the definition of a city. According to all scholars, that's the fundamental definition of a city.
Okay.
It's what you trade.
You split jobs. I no longer have to be a farmer or agriculture husbandry of animals for my family.
So
I can
tie your
process. Right. You can be a graphic artist, and he can be a Talmud scholar. He can be a medicine man. We split jobs, but therefore we have to trade with one another. And that's what gives rise to writing.
Good. So that's one take. What else defines a city? What's the fundamental defining nature of a city?
Maybe 10 people.
Protection.
Maybe 10 people.
A government.
Protection, a government.
I mean, a city as opposed to a town?
Yeah.
Density?
And today in airports, right? Just think about these answers and think about how the rabbis now, moving into this discussion, are really defining a city. So, walled city as well as everything that's near it. In other words, they're asking the question, what should happen to this town that's by the walled city? Should they read on the 14th or should they read on the 15th? B'chol anire imo, and everything that can be seen with it. Nidon kechrach is treated as a walled city, so anything that I can see out the little window of the wall, or, you know, kind of like there as I'm walking on the ramparts, that's a place that I could say is a walled city, and they should read it on the 15th. But do all the open towns and settlements around it really do this? This is the question of the Gemara. Tana taught. Samuch, an open town that is near a walled city, is treated what? As a walled city. Afa pisha eno nire, even though it really can't be seen from the city. Nire, an open town that can be seen from a walled city is treated as a walled city. Afa pisha eno samuch, even though it's not actually exactly right connected to the wall. In other words, when you walk out, it's a little distance away.
Suburban sprawl.
Right, you're talking about the first notion of suburban sprawl. A city that has walls can encompass another area. So I oftentimes think of, I lived in Detroit for a little while, right? They say Detroit for all the suburbs out that way. Every one of them's got a name. Every one of them's got a different little reality. But people say Detroit. The Gemara asks, Bishlama nire afal pisheino samuch. We understand that it can be seen as a walled city, even though it's not near it exactly physically. Mishkachat lakagon diyatva the Rosh Ahar. That can occur for example, the town is situated on top of a mountain. Eila samuch, afal pisha eno nire. But the case of an open town that's near a walled city, even though it cannot be seen from it, hechi mishkachat la. How is that possible? Can't see it? Should I really say it's part of the city? Amar Rab Yirmiya, sheir shevet benachal. Such is the case where it's sitting in the depths of a valley. You really can't see it. Because of some kind of landscape reality. It's right over there. People constantly going back and forth. It's okay, so you can't see it. Another teaching from Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, since we mentioned him before. As you know, the Gemara does it. V'amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, prach sheyashav l'sof hukaf nidon kichvar. Oh, but we're on the same topic. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi says, a city that was initially settled houses were built in it, and then was surrounded by a wall. At a later date, it's treated as a village, an unwalled city. A city that was initially settled, and then was surrounded by a wall, at a later date, is treated as a what?
Village.
As an unwalled city.
Wow.
My Tama, what's the reason for the ruling? It's written, if a man shall sell a residence in a walled city, Shehukaf Ulvasof Yashav, which implies that the city was first surrounded with a wall and then settled, Velosh Yashav Ulvasof Hukaf, and not first settled and then surrounded. So I have a way of reading a pasuk that says first it was a wall and then it was a city, therefore it's a walled city. And if it was the opposite way around, that what? In other words, it all goes on how you built it. If the wall was put up first, then what? Then it's a walled city. And if the wall was put up later, not a walled city. After teaching from Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi.
How many people put up walled cities and then moved in?
Oh, the Ottomans.
Well,
they put up the wall on the
wall. You build a dream. You build it and then you come.
Very good.
I mean, they advertise it. You will hear Purim on a certain day if you live here.
There you go. Perfect advertising plan. I like that. You should have been an ancient realtor. V'ama Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Since we're talking about Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi being the expert, we'll say another teaching. Krach, she'en bo asara batlanim. No, now he's going to tell you about what the primary elements of a city really are. Krach, she'en bo asara batlanim, nidon kechfar. A city that doesn't have 10 batlanim, who are constantly in the synagogue, unoccupied or unemployed men, who are constantly in the synagogue, nidon kichfar, is treated as a village.
You have to have a certain number of
kolelniks. Now, what is...
You want to have old ladies come and take your cookies from the synagogue, right? That's what you want. The same couple in Starbucks.
What is a batlan?
Lazy guy.
Good, because what are you building on there to say a lazy guy? Batel, we're talking about the shoresh of bet, tet, lamed.
People who are not occupied in a certain.
So on the one hand, it sounds like people who are not occupied. On the other hand, it sounds like they're lazy because they're a batlan. We use the word to say that it's like a lazy person. We've used it. So now let's see what the Steinsaltz translation is. Bet tetlam. That's the root of the Jewish word, of the Hebrew word.
Oh, no, how many of those?
Ten. Okay, now. Here's how the Koran translates it, because over there, again, it says, a city that does not have 10 unoccupied men who are constantly in the synagogue, Nidon Kichfar, is treated as a village. So that's the translation over that way.
All right, everyone else has to be gainfully employed because they're working too hard. So only when you have density can you have people who can be lazy.
And if a man's...
But I think these are not studying. I think they're...
Okay.
There.
Here's how it says.
Someone can help support.
Nevertheless, it was necessary for Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi to teach us halacha with regard to a large city to indicate that even if, what word did he use? Idlers.
Idlers.
If it has to have a walled city that does not have 10 idlers. Now, idlers, halachic concepts.
Yeah.
Rabbi Steinsaltz. A city that does not have 10 idlers is considered a village with regard to the Megillah reading, even if it is a large city. However, cities that were surrounded by a wall in the days of Joshua are always considered to be a city, even if they don't have 10 idlers. Are there others who dispute this? The Ramban, their opinion should be taken into account, etc. Now, another thing about idlers. Some explain that these 10 idlers are 10 men who do not have specific work and are consequently always available in the synagogue in order to ensure that there's a prayer quorum. Okay? This appears also to be the opinion in the Jerusalem Talmud. Some authorities, however, understand that the reference is a little different. The reference is to 10 men who are appointed to communal positions as follows. The Rashba teaches the following. Here are what they are. They are the three judges in town who make up the Beit Din.
It's a government.
Three charity collectors who bring the tzedakah. A scribe to write down transactions, debts, all kinds of law.
Right.
A cantor, someone who knows all of the prayers, the liturgies, the rites.
It's got to be somebody that slaughtered the animals.
An officer of the court, so that we go and actually enforce the law. And an elementary school teacher. Because, as we read last week, anybody who doesn't do that is what? Liable to death.
Isn't the teacher supposed to be teaching in a classroom instead of hanging out in the school doing nothing?
That is the classroom, obviously. Or that they can go to the classroom and come back at the prayer hour. So you make sure that those people are around so you have thriving Jewish life.
There's no shocker.
So interestingly, there's no shofar. Now, in later codes, in later codes, you're right. They want somebody to live near a mikvah, so you need an attendant. Someone to be a doctor. Already in the Middle Ages. Someone who practices medicine. Someone who can cut the meat, the shofar. And what else?
Moyel.
You need a moyel, someone who's in walking distance within the Tichum Shabbat, who can come if the eighth day is Shabbat. And if you don't have a moyel, what do?
Use the shofar.
Father can do it.
Father can be the
model,
right?
Yes.
No. Supposed to be the
model. Well, this is supposed to be the model. But you need to have home hospitality. So you need to make sure that your Beit Knesset is set up as a place where the person can stay. And that's why you had Kiddush in the Beit Knesset.
I'm not a caterer.
That's right. Forget it.
But
Let me read some of the other.
But can we switch the definition from the idler to the core people that run things? Why would you call those idlers?
That's the point. Some people see the word in the Gemara and they only think of the valence that these are lazy, these are no good nicks. These are people who are eating the, you know, they're eating the bissel of cake after minyan. They sit around, whatever you want to call the people who are kolel niks, who have a bad rap. Or the people who are, you know, kind of the group that has nothing better to do. That's not the case. The notion is that they were very fundamental to the Jewish community. It is your organized Jewish community. They were the ones who were supporting the Jewish value orientation, the teaching thereof, the adjudication, the notion of marketplace, and attracting people to what? Rashi will tell you, attracting people to market. Batlanim. She'betelin mimalachtan. I'm in the Rashi. I'm about three quarters down. The word betelin is bold. She'betelin mimalachtan. They didn't have to do any kind of work as in labor or, you know, the jobs in industry, if you will. Sheyehu mitsuyin tami bevet haKnesset. They should be found in the synagogue always. Shacharit ve'aravit. At the prayer service times, at the appointed times. Kid amrinam b'masechet brachot. As it's said in Masechet Brachot. Rashi makes the reference to a piece in Masechet Brachot that I copied for you in the packet. Look at the piece of Brachot. There's a page of Brachot and a translation of Brachot in your packet. It's after the Mishnah chapter. I'm on page. I'm sorry. There's no page number. The Gemara adds is on top. in the English translation? The Gemara adds. See it? After that. The Gemara adds. Laura, put that down. I think on top there. The Gemara adds. No. There.
Oh, on the very top. Oh, I got it.
The Gemara adds, right? Keep going. All right, keep going. Past that whole chapter. Keep going. And the English page. No, too far.
6 pages in from the end.
There you go. The Gemara adds.
Bye-bye.
See, the Gemara cites another teaching reported by Ravi and by Ravada?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Amar Ravi by Ravada, Amar Ravi Yitzchak. Kol ha-ragil lavolavet ha-knesset. Anyone who's accustomed to coming to the synagogue below ba yom echad and does not come one day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mashilbo. The Holy One, blessed be He, inquires about him. Shenemar, as it stated, Mi v'chem yirei Hashem shomei b'kol avdo. Who's there among you that fears Hashem, who listens to the voice of His servant? Asher halach hashevim ve'enoga. One who walked in darkness and does not have light. So God asks about the person. If im li dvar mitzvah halach, if he goes to do a mitzvah, right? Nogalo. He does have light. Ve'im v'dvar harishud halach. But if he went for the sake of an elective matter, earning a livelihood, ein nogalo. He doesn't have any light. The verse continues, Yivtach b'shem Adonai, let him trust in the name of God. My Tama, what's the reason that he doesn't have light? Mishum d'havalei livtoch b'shem Hashem v'lo batoch. Because he should have trusted God and been at the Beit Knesset. Now, Amar Rabbi Yochanan says, Shasha Kodesh Baruch Hu ba b'Beit Knesset, when the Holy One, blessed be He, comes to a synagogue, v'lo matza ba'asara, and does not find 10 men there, miyad hu koes, God immediately becomes angry. Shenemar, as it's stated, what? Madua pati v'ein ish karati v'ein one. Why is it that I've come and there's no man? Why is it that I've called and there's no one who answers? So this is what Rashi quotes in our page of Gemara and Megillah regarding the 10 batlanim. So has Rashi said that they are the officials of the government? No. Rashi says that they're constantly there to be available and that they didn't have to do their work. According to Brachot, they just had to not do their work because that brings light. And God won't get angry if we have 10 people who are in the Beit Knesset always. And He had a Beit Midrash, remember. And He promoted people being in the Beit Midrash. Now, he was a vintner, and he did some work, but I have a feeling that there's certain deep respect for, you know, the learning in and of itself. Now, Rashi is not exactly the same direction that everybody goes. People fill it out more. We saw the Rashba already with the jobs that were described. Let me read you just a couple more. Ramban says the following. Ramban. Tav she'ein tzarech she'yu batelim m'malachtan v'nizonim mishel tibor. The Ramban says the following. They don't really need to be completely without jobs and completely kept afloat by the public funds. U'mitzuyin kol ayom b'beit ha-knesset, and be in the shul the whole day long. That's not the point here, the Ramban explains. Obviously reading Rashi as if what? He's suggesting that they work. Eila di b'chach she'b'shara tefilot, that it's enough that at the ordained hours of prayer, yesh asaran hashim habetelim, that there are a certain group that is, quote-unquote, expected to be there and doesn't necessarily have other responsibilities in terms of the work, mimelachtan, uva'im levet ha-knesset lehit palel b'tzibor, and that they make a minyan. And that the important thing is that we have a minyan. And why today do we not use this measure or this standard in terms of our reckoning here? Remember, he's writing where? Spain. Here we don't even have to worry about this because we have enough people who are making minyanim at our shuls. What a great reflection of his time and in his moment, right? And we don't have to say we have to keep people totally afloat by the public fund who sit in synagogue and do this, and especially he's not living in a time when we can have our own complete government that's got so many cases and got so much charity collection that they're constantly busy. That's what I imagine. Now Meiri, it was 14th century in Ashkenaz. Hevi mishelot she'asara b'teilim nechlakein l'tzorech ha'ir. But there, the Meiri explains, they are really those who are hired by the public and who take care of municipal business, Jewish municipal business. Shlosh shal dayanim, three for judges. Shaliach hadayanim, a major legalist among the judges. Shnei gaba et tzedakah, two who concern themselves with tzedakah. Can't have one. Why? You got to wash each other. Mechalek ha-tzedakah, one who then gives it out. Sofer.
Scribe.
Chazan.
Cantor.
Milamed tinokot. Behem kivuim beveda
knesset
umizumanim letfilah. And they're based in the Beit Knesset, that's the administration building, if you will, and they're there for every minyan. Rambam says the following. Shelamad medivrei Rushalmi, that he learns from the Jerusalem Talmud, Shekatav Tneas Rebetali Memelach Tan Leveda Knesset. He expands it to 12. Now, why do you think he'd get away with 12? What?
Alternate jurors.
Alternate jurors, maybe?
Somebody didn't come.
It's also a good number by way of the Jews, right? You have 12 tribes. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Kagon Anu She'en Anu Trichim L'Talmideinu Kalomar Rabbi Yehuda Shehu Talmid Chacham Gadol. In other words, that one of the people who will be there will be a great Talmid Chacham. And what do I need? What's that Talmid Chacham able to do? Maybe he doesn't have to arrive every time to Minyan. Right? Because Talmud Torah is in the middle of Talmud Torah. Ve'en tzarich la'yem tzvarim yachol hipatel milimudo v'laso patrachei tzibur. And he shouldn't really have to stop his learning in order to deal with the needs of the public. Now that is a little bit of a different twist on this whole sugya that came right before, where what? You could be batel the Talmud Torah if you had some rabbinic meat, like Mikra Megillah. But maybe it's Mikra Megillah that's time, certainly, you know, we would say somewhat time-bound, and not just general needs of the public. So we want someone to be our kind of beacon of learning in our culture. I've expanded the list of 10 in order to include one of those. The Rambam, right, what's he think Olam Haba is all about? The world to come. He thinks it's about learning. So he's trying to create some sense, you know, the way I want to read it, trying to create some sense of Olam Haba in this world. And he explains it that way.
It's also very notable that you have to have so many people for the court, which implies that society was not stable and society was not pacific.
You needed a court.
Well, you needed three, four people out of the ten.
Four people out of the ten.
Who were associated with the court. And there was,
but you have to have a court of three.
I agree with that, but it's still notable that there must have been a continuous use of the
It was a city.
It was a city of 10 people. 10 Bakladim.
Go ahead,
Arvind. If you define it, a city as a place that has a minimum, let's say, of 10 Bakladim, you protect Beit Knesset, and now you're living in a thriving Jewish community like the Ramban, you don't need them. So this becomes a non-city if they're not there.
Oh, interesting. Right? So I don't think he would say that. I think he would say that since you have them at prayer time,
right,
it's absolutely a city.
Right.
Or in this case, you know, a krach and not a kfar. And you should read Megillah on the 14th, and you're not worried about this system.
So if we go back to what defines a city, I think it's sort of fun to use the example for the principles. So, you know, one principle is it's civilization. It's a structured, organized
hierarchy
to behavior and expectations. It's to have enough wealth to be able to support people who were not immediately involved in commerce or production in some way. It obviously requires a commitment to communal charity and communal norms,
right,
are the things that are implicit in this description.
Right, and that notion of the charity, you know, the gabbais of charity and one who disperses it, you know, that you have this massive amount of work to do about dispersing such, you know, not only funding, remember, In those times, they had a gemach, you had a soup kitchen in every place that you administered. You had more sharing, a la some of the articles that have come out recently about the Jewish community. Jack Wertheimer wrote about this, that the one thing that they do well is they have a baby gear gemach. They have a clothing gemach. They have a wedding dress gemach. Gimilut chasadim as the gemach. It's the bestowal of kindnesses. So they share all this. You know, we, of course, like a world where we get things new and no one else has used it before, and if you can afford that, you know, blessings. This is a world where a lot of that sharing, that charitable living, is really happening. And so I imagine that he's somewhat talking about that, even with the affluent realities that some of the communities had, that it's really at the core of it. The notion that you have law and legal enforcement in a certain way, and at least the discussion. So the idea that the Sefer HaChinuch shared, that I actually learned from Shaya, who was learning this for his bar mitzvah, as he's reading the mitzvah about Shoftim v'Shotrim, judges and officers of the court, is that the Shotrim had a really important job. And I was just talking about this with one of the guys who was on my trip with me, who was an assistant commissioner for police in Tanzania. The Shotrim in Sefer HaChinuch, the officers, are not just those with the power of arrest, a la the codes, if you break the law, we'll arrest you. They had a unique responsibility to teach the methodologies by which people could fulfill mitzvot. So they weren't teachers of children, per se. It wasn't the classroom. But the idea of community education is at the core of the Mosaic system, and then potentially within the rabbinic system, of what any officers were to do. They were to give over some of the drashot of the rabbis. Remember the people who we saw in Shabbat, chapter 16, who were supposed to come to the Beit Knesset in the afternoon, learn the law, and learn how to live it? Well, you needed some other agency for that. And the agency was put into the hands of the Shotrim, according to Sefer HaChinuch, the book of education on mitzvot, that one by one went through mitzvot. And this was something that Shai had shared with me that he found really interesting. And he said to me, you really get a kid thinking and, you know, take a little bit of, you know, just naches in this. He said, you know, didn't you once work with the fire department to actually teach people about stop, drop, and roll? And that's one of the aspects of my work in Washington with this fire chiefs organization is that we trained rank and file officers who had some propensity for education, along with the National Fire Protection Association, how to become the educators in their communities and how to do this public education. And the notion of having more public education about your civil society, what you ought to do, the good, and how to do the good. So I was talking to this guy who's this assistant commissioner, and he said the idea of community policing and actually police being involved in teaching people how to make more civil society is something they're playing with right now in Tanzania. Because the notion of lawlessness coming and eking up, because remember they were pretty democratic with some of the foundational ideas in the 60s of founders. But now, you know, kind of coming out and again and saying there's a purpose behind speaking the one language, Swahili. It's not just that we're by law demanding that you only have this language. They think that police can be involved in that as much as any of the other civil-minded educators in various neighborhoods. That's a pretty, you know, I think, neat notion of how this system could be at work, if indeed it was in their minds at all here. I'm not suggesting that I read anything deeply about, you know, how to set up that court officer and if he had deputies within the community and which rabbis were kind of appointees of the courts. But we do know that sometimes that indeed happened, that you had people with authority who were rabbinic in their approaches and not necessarily just empowered to be the powers of arrest within the community. So interesting take on what potentially lies within the community. We're not going to read through the next part of the Gemara that is about the arguing whether or not really they just lost the 10 Batlanim and then became a city that wasn't a city anymore, or they regained them at some point and then got the status back. But the notion that you had these important people within the Beit Knesset, at the end of 3b3, I'm going to go back to another Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi teaching to end the night. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Lod v'ono v'gei hecharashim mukafot choma mimot Yehoshua ben Nun havu. The cities of Lod, Ono, and Gai hecharashim were surrounded by walls in the days of Joshua ben son of Nun, and therefore read the Megillah on the 15th of Adar. And I simply point out to kind of wrap up tonight in this last little section, think about what's being said in the Gemara here and think about the return to Eretz HaKodesh today, to the land of Israel today, and some of the questions that people would have to ask moving into cities and regarding Purim. You know, they'd have to wonder some of these things this very day in terms of what was walled and what wasn't, and was it walled first and then houses were built, or were houses built and then the walls went up. You know, these are really serious questions in the land of Israel today. Gemara questions this whole thing about Lod and Ono and Gaia Cherashim. That's in the territory of Binyamin, right? Just kind of north of Jerusalem. Did Joshua build these cities? Vahane Yeshua bin Anahi? Vaha Alpa'al bin Anahi. Alpa'al built them. As it says, Dichti v'nei Alpa'al Ever Misham v'Shamed, and the children and the sons of Alpa'al will ever Misham and Shamed. He built what? Who bana et Ono v'et Lod uvnoteha? He built Ono and Lod and its dependencies. So the Gemara is based on this premise that when it says that someone built a city, it implies that the city was not in existence beforehand. So that's somewhat of a logical assumption, right, about a verse within Chronicles. He built it, meaning, okay, he settled it. Ula tamech, but according to your premise, Asa bin Anahi, because Asa lived after Alpa'al built them, dichtiv vayiven Asa et areha bitzurot asher liyuda. And it's written, and Asa built fortified cities which are to Judah. Now, that's an interesting thing because, as it says in the Masorah Shas, meaning that you have some parentheses, the verse that's being quoted is not found anywhere in our Tanakh.
What a draft coming through there.
Oh, it kept you awake.
What's the explanation for that? It's the verse is being quoted and it doesn't actually...
Nice. A word. They had maybe a different tradition of reading aloud. They had a word, just like we have sometimes Ketiv and Kri. Maybe they had a Hosafa. Maybe they had a word that was extra. That word, you know, happened to be Asa. And the verse is Vayiven Arei Mitzurah B'Yehuda, and he built fortified cities in Judah. So we can assume that Asa built these, and maybe also because it was the assumption that he did, that the name was included. Anyway, Rav Elazar says the following: Hani mukafot choma mimot Yehoshua ben Nun. These cities were surrounded by walls in the days of Yehoshua ben Nun. Haru bimei pilegish ubegivah. They were destroyed during the whole Compifine and Givah episode that's said in the Book of Judges. Va'ata Elpa'al bin Anahi, and Elpa'al came and rebuilt them. Hador in polata Asa shepitzinhu. They again fell, and Asa came and restored them. The Gemara proves the assertion that Asa merely restored the cities that were in existence instead of actually built them. Daikanami, a precise reading, is also bears this out. Dichti bayomer Lehuda nivne et ha'arim ha'ele. It's written, and he, Asa, said to Judah, let us build these cities miklal, the arim havu meikara. By calling them cities, he implies that they were regarded as cities from before, and that he would know what the person is talking about. Shama mina, and we learn from this that the cities built by Asa were already in existence, and Asa merely restored them. So that you have this notion that a city can have a life way beyond its life now. One can restore it a la the walls. One could restore it to a time of glory, looking back at how the city actually did what? Had a policy about Batlanim as well. My assertion is that depending on every makom v'makom, and it's certainly the case with the way that it actually worked, I don't want to just read backwards and say that all these different rabbis of the Middle Ages had different interpretations of what it really meant to have a quote-unquote established Jewish community, city, that you didn't have to call, you know, village-like, right? That ultimately, if you had different approaches vis-a-vis the administration, vis-a-vis how many people were in your sacred space on a consistent level, whether or not there was a Talmid Chacham employed, whether or not, like the Rambam, the Talmid Chacham didn't have to get up from his work, that these different systems were ways of having city life, and if you wanted to rebuild them, you could rebuild them either exactly the way that you had before in relation to the sacred precincts and the sacred municipal management system, or you could have a whole different kind of take on that. And I think coming at the end of such a piece is the rabbi's way of saying is that you can recover a Jewish place and define it in current times with the notion that one generation after another will ultimately restore. Could be just a closer read saying when you consider these cities, if they were walled in the time of Yeshua, and they're not quote unquote walled now, that we shouldn't upend the tradition that they have there, that they were walled in the time of Yehoshua bin Nun, and don't ask the question don't ask the question, in other words, when someone tells you that they were walled in the time of Yehoshua bin Nun, we could read the verse in such a way that allows us to define it that way, and they can read on the 15th and we're done.
It seems strange to freeze it at a moment, at that moment in time.
You mean the Yehoshua ben Nun issue?
Yeah.
Well, we talked about that. They wanted to attribute it, the Rishonim says, to the notion of the glory of Israel and the conquering of Israel, bringing it all back to that. And here they wanted to establish a way of looking at the history of a place, so that there was no question going forward in terms of the rabbinic decree of reading the Megillah, and when that group of people defined it as whether it's the 13th, 14th, or 15th, they weren't going to really question.
But I, what springs to my mind upon is that this is an unstated allusion to Jerusalem regaining its glory. That by making the provision that a city that existed in, at that time, even if it undergoes a change, so it's no longer meeting the criteria, can be restored, I think that it just calls to mind that this is thinking about the centrality of Jerusalem.
Could be. It could be that ultimately God's promise will be fulfilled. Jerusalem as part of it. The notion of the Jewish inheritance of the land, and the Jewish homeland, and the God's promise of the promised land, all wrapped up in there.
We need to change dominion and we call it from now Batlanim.
We're looking for 10 Batlanim. Thank you. My pleasure. Good to see everyone. Hanukkah begins next Tuesday, and Wednesday we'll obviously learn, and we'll light the Hanukkah together. Hello.